Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our weekly conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us anytime during the show, the phone lines are open. Here's the number, 941-3689. That's 941-3689. If you're calling us from Oahu, that's the number to use. And if you're on the neighbor islands or listening to the live stream someplace else, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. Now, a few weeks ago on The Conversation, we met Frank Garcia. He's been clean and sober and productive for 10 years, all following a difficult past with drugs and crime, starting at age 17. He has helped other formerly incarcerated people to reenter life on the outside through a process of restorative justice. Some call it reparative justice. Either way, the process of confronting the emotions and loss caused by an inmate's actions is painful. If done well, though, it can mean a whole new life. Just ask Frank, who is back with us tonight. Also back with us is Lauren Walker. She's done most of her restorative justice work in Hawaii through the nonprofit Hawaii Friends of Justice and Civic Education. And last month, she was selected for a 5-year term on the Fulbright Specialist roster for peacemaking and conflict resolution. She directs the Huikahi Restorative Circles Group. It brings together stakeholders who want to participate in an incarcerated person's self-directed transition and draws together family and friends and victims to focus on their needs to create healing all around. So what does it take for an incarcerated person to make a restorative justice success story? And what can Circle participants expect? Martine would know all about it. She's just participated in a restorative justice circle with her mom, who is still in prison. And they're all here around my table, and you're with us tonight, too. We want to hear from you. Have you participated in any type of restorative justice circle or group with a friend, family member, or someone who has harmed you? And even if you haven't, would you? And do you think that restorative justice circles should become the norm for offenders who qualify? Here's our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And thank you both for coming back, Lauren and Frank. And nice to meet you, Martine. And thank you for being willing to come in here and share some of your story with us, too. You can say hello. It's okay. Lauren.
Hi.
When we talked a few weeks ago, and people hear, you know, the term restorative justice, and they have some idea of what that means. It's a concept that's been around for thousands of years in one form or another, but it seems as if it's just sort of hit that trendy sweet spot lately where people are focusing on what this means. Give us some context for what we see in Hawaii as opposed to what's going along in the rest of the country.
Sure, Beth Ann. Thanks for having this show, too. There's a lot of restorative practices actually going on in Hawaii. One thing that's been going on since about 1996 is it's called Ohana conferencing, and it's for child abuse and neglect cases that the Department of Human Services and the Family Court, Judge Town, formerly Judge Town, Michael Town, he's retired now and is a member of the parole board. He got a grant back in 1994 to develop this process, and it's a really great process where families, they follow the Maori tradition, which restorative justice is based on Indigenous people's practices, but Westerners got more interested in it again in the 1970s, and actually Westerners also used to do restorative practices until the Norman Conquest, which was, you know, about 1,000 years ago, and then the king took over all the conflict. And so then the king was the one who decided all of the conflicts. But before that, Westerners too, you know, Europeans used to settle things like the native peoples. Many native peoples still do, indigenous cultures. So Judge Town, he got this grant that started the Ohana conferencing program. And they've done thousands and thousands of circles for families who are trying to determine what's in the best interests of children when there's been cases of neglect or abuse. And the Maori model that they follow has the people come in. So it's different from our model that we do, the thing we do. And with the child protective cases, the Ohana conferencing, they bring in social workers. And so it's more social worker driven Our process is not driven by social workers or professionals.
It's all the people who are involved.
Yes, it's just the people involved and the person who is in prison. Yeah, that's how our process is. The good thing about Ohana Conferencing, though, is they have this piece called private time where the family can be alone without the professionals, and then they can kind of come together, you know. So,
well, when you're dealing with minor children, I mean, it's a very, very different situation
yes.
altogether. But here you're talking about, you know, people who have been incarcerated because they've done something to hurt a lot of other people and society at large. And the question is, how do you create some sort of healing with that for the person who at some point most likely is going to be released into society and hopefully successfully? But there are a lot of other people who carry that, too. It's not just one person going and making, you know, restitution to society and is let out again.
Right. And the beauty of restorative justice is really that it focuses on the people who have been harmed. You know, our other systems, our legal system doesn't really look at the people who've been harmed. What we do, like in our criminal justice system, is we find out who did the crime, and then we prove that they did the crime, and then we punish them. You know, and then we do a lot of times, most of the time, judges do order restitution be paid. And another thing is, too, which you probably don't know, most people are surprised, 97%, almost approximately 97% of all convicted felons pleaded guilty. They admitted that they did this crime. And it for sure, it is driven by plea bargaining, which is a whole nother issue. But the fact that they did say that they did do it, to me, for, you know, since I've been into this work for about 20 years, I was always like, well, shouldn't we be asking them what you're going to do about it? And shouldn't we be asking the people who were harmed, what do they need? You know, what do they need to repair the harm?
And how did that affect your life when you were actively an attorney and dealing with this?
Well, when I was an attorney dealing with it, I mean, I didn't really. Yeah, I quit being an attorney because it was like, I mean, I'm still an attorney. I've been licensed
you're
to
just
practice
not,
law.
But right. You're just not practicing.
Well,
I
say I practice restorative. I'm a restorative lawyer, and I try to help people find healing. And I develop programs and I do research. I have a different, you know, restorative lawyers are, it's a new thing. it's a new way.
Kind of why we're talking about it, Laura, because although there may be traditions of restorative justice for thousands of years and even in the last 20 or 30 here in Hawaii, the way people are looking at it now and the fact that you could have a career doing this is probably not something that someone could have envisioned even, you know, 30 or 40 years ago.
Right. I'm not sure. It's not a real well-paid career.
Didn't ask you what it paid.
Okay.
There are other good things that you do it for.
Yeah.
But looking at the people around this table with us, you know, we've got Martine here, young girl, 24 years old, and she has a mom who's in prison. And Frank, who has already paid his debt to society, helping other people do the same thing. And you just had your very first circle for you, Frank.
Yes.
And it was something that came about when we were talking on the conversation. Didn't realize you hadn't ever had a circle with all the other circles that you'd participated in for other people. And I got a call shortly after, and you said, I'm having a circle. How
yes.
was it?
Oh, it was a good experience for me. It just totally lifted everything off my shoulders. I got to be able to apologize to all the people that I did do a wrong to, and they got to exactly tell me how they felt about what I've done to them also.
No holds barred. I mean, it was pretty intense.
It was real intense. It was. They didn't hold nothing back, but I got to feel how they really felt about me, you know, that they did care. And that was a big plus for me. And then they didn't hold no grudges, like you said. And also that they do have a lot of plans for me. They put a plan of action as far as small little goals to participate in with the family. And
can you give me an idea of what some of those small little goals, without trespassing on your privacy, but just some things that you say small little goals, what would be a small little goal that they put together?
Just some of the stuff that I have problems with, small little anger problems here and there, being more patient, also participating in some church activities and other activities with the family.
So things they're asking of you to be able to deal more effectively with them or to participate in community activities with them.
Exactly. Participation is a big thing now. Before, I would always hold back and not want to be a part of. Today, after I had that, I feel part of the family. So,
even after all this time that you've been out of prison?
Yeah, even all this time out of prison, to tell you the
10
truth.
10 years is a long time, and basically it's kind of way back there somewhere, not that you ever forget it, but it made such a difference, this circle?
Yeah, it big time, because I held all that guilt for that long time. I've been out for that 10 years, and it just after that day, it was just a totally different me. I'll tell you the truth, it really did help as far as, you know, all the guilt and the shame that I had. I just put everything out there, trusting that everything's going to come back okay, and which it did. And today I have some plans of actions. You know, I'm participating with the family, and, you know, good things are happening. Looking up to good examples that they're setting for me that I never did have as when I was growing up in my family. So, you know, it's still a learning experience for me at 45 years old. So
Well, that's good to hear. Hopefully it'll be the way it is the rest of your life.
Yes.
But Martine, as you listen to Frank's story with all this, this seems remarkably different from what you told us about your own story.
Well, sorry. Yeah, it'd be a little different. Probably don't have the same relationship with my mother.
Because she's the one who's incarcerated, not you, but you're the one who's participating with her.
Yeah, I mean, she's actually not incarcerated anymore. She's still in a halfway house, I think, right now. It was good for me just because I was able to talk to her and tell her, like, the things that she's done and how she made me felt. But the really big thing for me was my grandmother and her mother. She wasn't able to be there, but she had printed or typed out everything she wanted to say as if she was there, and I got to read her words. And me and my grandmother, like, we have a good relationship, but we never talk about my mom at all. Just kind of ignore that whole thing. So it was just kind of interesting to actually read what she felt and how she was feeling and what she was doing, like, through the whole thing, through her entire life of having my mother and stuff. So that was actually kind of eye-opening.
Were there feelings that you also felt toward your mother that were pretty consistent with your grandmother's?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because my grandmother, like, lives in California and then would call me and say, can you go find her? Can you go see what she's up to? Before she was incarcerated, when she was, like, on the street and whatever, and be like, can you make sure she's okay? And I'm like, I really don't want to go down to Chinatown and go find some cracked out person. So I was just kind of, it was weird to see her, like, showing all, like, the hurt part more than, like, the, oh, can you go make sure? And it was just different.
She was still being a mom, though, no matter what your mother was doing.
Yeah.
She wanted to know that her kid was okay, even if she had to send her grandkid to find out.
Mm-hmm.
Right now with your mom, do you have a relationship?
No, not really. I mean, we talk maybe once a month on accident. But I run into her a lot.
You pick up the phone and she's there.
Yeah. But I run into her a lot because her halfway house isn't too far away from my apartment. We do go same places. I think she was in a program on the other side of the island near some of my friends' houses, so I run into her there. So,
but I think the point that I hear you making is that even though you've had this experience with her, this is not a case necessarily of happily ever after, at least not yet.
Yeah. I mean, it was, yeah.
Well, the good news is you got time.
This is true.
And you also can make some choices to be part of her life or not be part of her life, right?
Mm-hmm. And also for that circle, like, she kept – there's a part of it that's about goals and about, like, what she needs to achieve. And I feel like I was able to make it clear to her that she needs to do one goal at a time, not jump, mm-hmm. like, a million things. Like, she was saying how she wants to have this great relationship and we'll have, like, a family thing together. And I was like, well, first I just need you to stay clean and then we'll see if we can go from there.
And so how did she take that message when you said to her, you know, let's not jump to Christmas morning, but let's just dishes first?
I feel like she really thinks she's there. Like, I am clean, I am sober, but she has been clean, she has been sober before, and it only takes, you know, a few months or a year or 2 years where it's all for nothing. So,
is there going to be a point though where, you know, you can foresee yourself having a good relationship with her? Does it have to be a time-based thing? Because you say she's fallen off the wagon after a month or a year, maybe even 2 years.
Oh.
Is there any point in time where you might think, well, okay, she stayed sober this long?
Well, I mean, I guess it's not about a time thing because it's more like her actions. Because I might not, like, reach out to her, but there's certain things that I do. Like, I invited her Thanksgiving last year, and she decided to blow me off. And that was probably, like, one of the big – Thanksgiving is the biggest and most important holiday to me. So the fact that she just blew me off completely, I was like, okay, I never invite you to anywhere. I don't do this. So the last time, There's like a bunch of things where she'll just be like, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm like, okay, well, I'll be here waiting. And then she doesn't do it. And I'm like, those are the things that you need to do. And not even like big things. Like I invited her over to my house, actually not even that long ago, to pick up some books that she wanted from me. And she called me 2 days later. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm like, I know you're sober and clean, so I don't know why you couldn't have just picked up your phone to tell me you're not going to come because I stayed home waiting for you to pick up the books. It's just like little things where I'm like, if you're going to try to...
Broken promises, big and small?
Yeah. Which is like, it's not even that big of a deal.
If only she would just pick up the phone and acknowledge you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, clearly having a circle and saying a lot of the things that you and your grandmother and other people presumably said too mm-hmm. makes some impact, you hope, but doesn't necessarily mean that you walk out feeling like Frank did or your mom is able to put her life together the way other people have. It's a process, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel like I'd wish that she had like the same reaction as yours where she actually took in a lot of what people were saying. But I feel like even when we're sitting there in the circle, she was just kind of like, oh, yeah, I'm doing this because I'm doing this. Not like really absorbing all the stuff that was going on. And, you know, I mean, some things she took in and some things you could tell that she would just kind of roll her eyes kind of thing, but not directly.
If you've just joined us tonight on Town Square, we're talking about restorative justice circles and the process that someone who has been incarcerated goes through if they choose, if they do the work. It's not for everybody, but if it can happen, it does happen with people who have been wronged, whether that's victims or friends or family who come together and say the true dirt and everything they need to express within the circle and process. And sometimes it is very successful, and sometimes it's moderately successful, and sometimes it needs even more work. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you have a question for Frank or Martine, who you just heard speaking a moment ago, or Lauren Walker, who directs the program that both have participated in, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Would you participate in a restorative justice circle for someone that you cared about if they had hurt you deeply? Would you be willing to do that? Or perhaps you've already done it. Would you be willing to share your experience with us? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Lauren, we have not quite opposite stories in Martine and Frank, but they are very, very different. And less that we give the impression that somehow somebody has a restorative justice circle and everything winds up sounding as good as Frank's. How representative are these two types of stories to what happens as you see many people going through the process?
I think they're very representative. The thing, Martine, the circles aren't just for the person who is incarcerated. They really are for the family. And Martine, I think, and her grandmother did get some healing from it, which is the purpose. And
they got a load off their chest.
Yeah,
that's
yes,
for sure.
Yes, to be able to express and to be able to share, to see that they were both, you know, on the same page and, you know, these things. So I think it's really representative. We've done 103 of these circles since almost 10 years. And all of them were in Hawaii except for five. One we did in Helsinki, Finland, one in New York, and three in California. The program is being replicated in California and New York. So I've seen the whole spectrum. But what I want to say, though, is that we've had almost 500 people participate in these circles, not just family and the person in prison either. We always have someone from the prison who works at the prison or who's like a drug treatment counselor or someone like that. And to date, almost 500, it's 496 surveys. Every single one of them, people have said that it was a positive experience. Not one person said that it was negative. They all found something positive in it, which I think is really says a lot about our, you know, need for addressing how we've been harmed and what
can
be
heal.
Done. Yeah, what can be done to repair the harm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people, I don't think there's few of us who can say we have been unharmed in any sort of way. Learning how to do this kind of restorative justice circle, not necessarily in the context of someone's life where there's incarceration as part of it, but just in general, how do we talk to each other about some of these same really thorny issues and not carry it forward? and not have it be the thing that, you know, strikes with a heart attack or stress or all the things that we tend to carry.
Yeah. Yeah. We see people who come into the circles and they are really nervous and really, and people have said stuff, you know, when we're arranging these, we're convening them, people will say, oh, he won't come or he's going to be all mad, and, you know, family members and stuff. And, but then when they come, they are kind of nervous and a little uptight, but when they leave, everyone is just has this relaxation. And that's one of the reasons I keep doing this work, is I love this. It's just such great work to see people be so, have so much humanity. And the circles too, even though people do, they're really honest. You know, people are very honest. They are always respectful. People have always been respectful in all of these circles.
Even when they're saying really, really hurtful things?
Yes.
Is that what you found too, Martine, when people were sharing some deep emotions about your mom, you and your grandmother? Certainly there was a great deal of respect in the way that was given.
Yeah, I think so.
So nobody felt, and certainly not with your circle, Frank, that anyone was feeling ashamed of telling you how they were feeling or feeling that they were carrying a great deal of guilt for making you feel bad.
No, not at all. I even asked them, don't hold back on this. Go ahead and just say what you got to say. You know what I mean? It's at that time, it's kind of selfish at the time. Everybody's got to take it for themselves. Like Lauren said, that it's not just for the person that's harmed everybody. It's for the other people. And to me, they got a lot out of it also. After I left, I just felt something so different, a different kind of, I mean, I knew I was always with the family, but I never felt part of the family until after that night. And that was just a great experience for me. It was awesome.
It's, in a way, amazing to hear you say that you never really felt part of the family until having had this experience, because you've been part of this family for a long time.
28 years we've been together. And it's just always, I was always there, the outsider. And but I was always the one that always tried to help out and be part of the family, but I just never did feel a part of, even with my own family, because where I was raised was, you know, a lot of drugs and a lot of bad things happening. And I never had a good example in my life. And then until today, after now I feel part of the family, you know, it feels like, you know, things are going in the right direction for me.
If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about restorative justice circles, people who come together with people they've harmed, friends, relatives, and try to make restitution or at least come to some place of healing. Usually there is a case of someone who has been incarcerated, maybe coming into civilian life, trying to make that transition. Not always, but very often that's the case. For you, would this be something that you would participate in? Would you come and be that honest to someone as they're trying to potentially make some sense of restoration of a relationship with you? If you have someone who is in prison, would you be part of a restorative circle like this one? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And usually a lot of you will call and talk about how it's so important that we have more of humanity toward those who are in prison and understand that when they get out, they're going to be our friends and neighbors and coworkers and, you know, people you pass by on the street. So it's in everybody's best interest to see that everyone is healthy and well. But the question is, sometimes when it comes down to you participating, would you do it? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I know we've got a lot of sensitive topics that we're talking about tonight. You guys are quiet, but I want to hear what you have to say about this. 941-3689. Lauren, when you hear Frank talk about the fact that all these years he could carry that kind of guilt, even though he had paid his debt to society, came out, completely redid his life and turned it into the success that he is becoming now, is that a normal thing that even after someone comes out of prison and has done all these things and has helped other people and gotten down deep with others, that until you're kind of the middle one in the circle there and people are talking to you, that it doesn't fully lift?
Well, yes, I think that people who have, especially in our criminal justice system, people who have committed a crime and are incarcerated are deeply shamed. We take these people, we put them in uniforms. We call them, we don't even call them people. We call them inmates. And they're treated really like numbers. And And they're, the people who run the prisons are told not to develop any relationships with them. Even if you volunteer in the prisons, they tell you not to. You're not supposed to touch them. You know, you're not supposed to touch them. And so it's a very dehumanizing. Our prison system is very dehumanizing, and it's totally shame-based. So until I think you do have a process like these reentry circles where you can express your shame, I think that it's humans have a need to express their shame and be vulnerable and then be welcomed back, you know, to have that cooperative love. You know, I think that humans, it is a natural thing. And I think it would be so wonderful if every single person who came out of prison had one of these. Actually, I think if they had them before they even went into prison, you know, when they were convicted, if they had a circle, it would be so great, because then as they did time in prison, they would have their supporters. They would have their family who cared about them and, you know, their friends, and they would do better prison time. In fact, we've seen just amazing things. Women and men who are incarcerated, one of the things they say they're going to repair the harm for the community at large, not just their family and the people they know, but other people who, you know, the taxpayers who had to pay for them to be in prison and the people they sold drugs in the neighborhood, that kind of stuff. So we've had people actually say that one of the ways they're going to repair the harm is to obey prison rules. So I think that in itself is a huge justification for this program.
Understanding that there are rules and they broke some other ones, and
yes,
now it's time to change their ways.
Yeah.
But when you say having a circle coming into prison, mm-hmm, isn't this more maybe a function of just being ready for this kind of experience, mm-hmm, as opposed to a function of time?
We have found that the way we do this program is people apply for it. They fill out an application and then the prison sends it to us. And then we go interview them. And all of the people, when we interview them, they get so much out of it. This model that we use is based, it uses, I had a teacher named Insu Kim Berg. She was a master therapist, and she was very well known internationally and in the United States. And she helped me develop this model. And so it's based on solution-focused approaches. So it's based on a very optimistic, positive psychology. And people want to. It's how you use your language. And people, if you invite people to take responsibility, they do. You know, it's when you're hammering them, saying, what's wrong with you? Why did you do that? You know, people naturally, humans have the natural tendency to be defensive when they are criticized and blamed. All humans do, you know. And so instead, the way we do it is very positive, you know, that you applied for this. I mean, I think most people do want, they want to be a member of a group. And unfortunately, some of the groups they end up with, like gangs and stuff, aren't that healthy. And if you can do these kind of processes, people can get in better social systems and do better. And research actually shows restorative, that's why it's really working now. We've showed it's become an evidence-based approach. And actually,
I mean, this is not all just airy-fairy and hugs and kisses.
No, there's a lot. In fact, all of our work, the Hawaii Friends of Justice and Civic Education, we do research. All of our work is evidence-based. We do research. We've published all of our stuff. We've got books. We've done all kinds of – it's research-based. It's not just airy-fairy, you know, big hug stuff.
You've managed to have 103 people have this experience in the last 10 years?
Yes, nine. Mm-hmm. Okay. Almost nine.
Almost nine.
Yeah.
Okay, so in almost a decade, you've been able to have these 100 and some odd people touch the lives of, 300 and some odd others? Can you tell me about, there's about 500 people,
yeah,
who've had,
mm-hmm,
some contact with restorative, mm-hmm, justice circles. And then for some people, that sounds like, well, that's kind of a small number, knowing what our prison population,
mm-hmm,
is.
Yeah.
And obviously, this is not for everybody. This is,
mm-hmm,
not meant,
right,
for violent crimes and horrific, mm-hmm, things that have happened. Although
we've actually
done
cases
where that has happened,
yes,
too.
Yes.
But in general, the program that you talk about, mm-hmm, here is for crimes that aren't at that level.
No,
of
they're
violence.
We have violent crimes. Yeah. No, we've had people who have murdered people. Have these circles.
In Hawaii, these,
yeah,
circles too.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, then I,
yeah,
misunderstood.
Yeah.
So with all of that said, how then do you start to bring this into that system, because there's a cost associated with all of this. It may not be a lot, but still, you know, you mentioned you don't make a lot, but you're still working. There are other people who have to be involved with it. There are circles that have to be drawn, people who have to be contacted. To be able to integrate this into our prison system now as we know it, do you have any idea of what this would cost taxpayers?
Well, we have a proposal right now just to do, like, I think, I can't remember if it was 50 or about 50 circles maybe, and then research it for about, it was either 50 or 100, I can't remember, I'm sorry. And it was like, I think the budget was just like $75,000. You know, it wasn't very much. And I have a grant right now to research, to do research from a foundation. So, you know, it's possible, and it's going to happen, actually. I think our prison, Ted Sakai, who is the director of our prisons, really recognizes this. We started this program when he was the warden at Wyava Prison, and he comes from a social work background, and he recognizes the importance of family involvement in rehabilitation and the how it benefits the families, too.
Which was a big issue when we had prisoners very, very far away and trying to bring them back again so they could have the benefit of having that kind of safety net.
Right. And besides prisons, we've done a lot of work. One of our first projects was with juveniles and with the Honolulu Police Department. And we diverted 104 kids, juveniles, from the regular police, you know, court system to restorative circles, restorative conferences, and they were really successful. And that actually, that program has been written up by UNICEF, you know, the UN committee, as a model for a diversion program. And I'm confident that it is going to move in that direction.
So this, if you and I are talking to each other 20 years from now, you think this is going to be mainstream at that point?
Yes, that absolutely.
This will be part of the process if someone enters the prison system. This is going to be one of the first steps for them.
I think so.
Or that may divert the kids so they never even enter.
Yeah, and hopefully what my big thing I really want is for the Department of Education, the public schools, to do this. Because if public schools flipped their discipline from, you know, retribution and punishment, zero tolerance, instead if they had restorative practices, I think that we could prevent all kinds of problems. Because a lot of kids get into trouble because of social problems, and they could be addressed. Like Frank came from a childhood of, you know,
No, Frank, tell some of your story that you're comfortable to talk about in the context of what you know now. It's hard to put yourself back to being that 17-year-old, perhaps, and you look at life a little differently when you're 17 than you do when you're 45. But if Lauren's supposition is true, that somehow this might change lives if we change the way we look at how, you know, we punish or how we create some sense of healing after someone has been harmed in some way, how do you look at that now? And do you see that that makes sense for someone who might have done the things you did at 17?
It makes a lot of sense because it sets a plan up for that person. It, it helps that person actually see himself or herself in a different point of view. It would help them in a way where they wouldn't be repeating the same things over and over as far as bad things. It would help them, you know, repeat the good things that the circle would put out for them.
So, like, describe to me a circle that you think would work with a 17-year-old who has gotten involved with drugs as you did. What would have made an impact?
It would actually be able to help them take a look at theirself also, to take a look where they want to go. And actually, it shows the harm that they do to the person, which you didn't even think you did. You harm a lot of people that you never thought you harmed. And when I had my circle, I didn't realize how much hurt I did to everybody, not only to the main family members that I did hurt, but to the kids, that my nieces and nephews that did look up to me. And that's a big thing, too, because that's, you know, that's the kids, and you're setting an example for them, and you're doing the wrong things. You're throwing the wrong message to the kids.
They participated in this circle with you?
Actually, no. Actually, the young kids, they didn't, but the parents spoke for them and how they felt. And I was really surprised how some of the answers that the parents did give me. And I didn't know how much the kids looked up to me and cared so much and couldn't believe that what had happened and how I was locked up for so long.
But in trying to prevent something like that happening, if Lauren is right that we need to change the model in school and the way that we deal with kids. You know, Martine, you're not that far away. You may be 24, but you can look back and see 16 or 17 fairly easily, I would imagine. When you hear Lauren talk about how perhaps in school this is the kind of model we ought to use, does that make any sense to you? Do you think a kid's going to listen and be able to get a lot out of a circle?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it puts more focus on you when you're a teenager. I assume you're just like, you don't care about yourself. You don't care about anything. You want to do whatever you want to do. You don't realize like your friends, your family, your teachers, you might even hurt and you don't even realize it because you're like, oh, they're just old people. It doesn't matter. But if like they turned it around on you and like you need to take a little responsibility and actually see what you're doing, you know, might make them think for more than 2 seconds about like what just happened or what they did. But
when you think back on the experience with your mom and the circle and how you deal with your brother, has it changed that relationship? Do you deal with him in the same kind of way, as you just mentioned, turning it back on him and trying to let him see this through some different eyes?
Yeah, usually. Well, I try to remind him that I was there not too long ago, and he's doing the same thing that I'm doing. That I was doing, and he probably like I didn't finish college yet, and he's struggling through school right now. So I was just like, you know, I know what you're doing. I know you want to go hang out with your friends and not do your homework and stuff, but you might want to think about it.
But that's kind of, you know, the benefit of having been a teenager not that long ago. But specifically, Lauren, through the restorative justice model, with kids who have issues at school and at home, this is sort of, you know, the nonviolence method moved over a few notches or ratcheted up a little bit in terms of putting it back on you and being able to see how your own behavior is affecting other people.
Right.
And it's not just making a victim situation.
Right. And it's a way the community can participate. I was so lucky. Well, I mean, it wasn't really. My son was assaulted when he was at Waialua Intermediate School about, I guess he's 27, so however many years ago that was, you know, 13 some years ago or something. And he was assaulted. It was when we were doing this HPD program with the kids. And I was like, oh, my God, I need a circle. You know, I need a circle for me because I'm going to be worried that he's going to get in a fight with this kid again. You know what I mean? Because it's a kid who they'd grown up together. They'd played soccer and they always were fighting, these two boys, you know. And so the one boy smacked my son in school one day. And so the principal called me, and I realized I had to have a circle. So I was so lucky I was able to get a facilitator who we had trained for the police program to come and do a circle. And the boy and his father came. And before the circle, I had heard all this stuff about the father, that he had been in prison. And the boy's mother used to tell me at the soccer games, you know, that the father had been in prison and was, you know, kind of abusive or something. And so anyway, I was like all, you know, kind of freaked out. And my husband came, and we had it at the Waialua Elementary School because the intermediate school couldn't do it. And the principal at the Waialua was Bonnie Tabor. She's the principal at Waikiki Elementary now, I think. And Bonnie was there, and she'd known both boys their whole, you know, from like whenever they were really young. And it was an amazing experience. The father of the boy thought that I was, because I do have a house on the beach, but it's like, not, you know, I'm not, he thought I was like, had gone to private school. And I was like, no way, dude, I'm a high school dropout. You know, I only went to the ninth grade and I went to law school because I want to help kids like me, you know, because I was in trouble. I was in lockup when I was 16 and had, you know, difficulties. I had social problems, you know, a family that was kind of messed up, and I lived on my own when I was only 14. And so anyway, he got to see me, what I was really like. You know, and I got to see him. He was not just a, you know, ex-con that was a bad man. He was a wonderful father who really did care about his boy. And that circle we had was amazing. And I know Bonnie Tabor still remembers it because she and I were both crying our eyes out. And the father, after that circle, every time I would see him, we would hug. You know, we became like friends with each other, and the boys never had a problem again. And when they were like seniors in high school, I'd seen the boy one day on the other side of town, and my son was in the car, and I said, oh, look at so-and-so, you know, got out of school kind of early, you know, obviously cut school. I go, how did he get over here so early? And my son said, Mom, you know, he's a fast walker. And I just realized, you know, these boys had settled things in the eighth grade and they never had another problem.
So if we know that this works.
Yeah.
Okay.
We do know it works. And research shows it works.
It's not just your experience. It's not just Frank's experience, Martine's experience. It's ever evolving. But especially if you look at the situation with schools, trying to prevent it from coming into a situation where you have somebody who's incarcerated, trying to create a situation where people can have a better chance at talking over their differences, or at least being able to understand what harm they've caused to each other and make reparations and some form of restitution as they go forward without there having to be a prison situation involved.
Yes.
If we know all this, why is it so difficult for us to not be so punitive?
I don't know why, but all I focus on is how to get the change. You know, I don't know why it's like it is, but I know how to try to work to get what I want.
Well, I meant that almost in a practical way, too, because when you talk to other schools and when you talk to other organizations, you know, do they come and say, oh, that's great, fine, let's do that? Or are you met more with, I don't know whether we can do this or that won't fit in, some of the negatives and the I can'ts part of it, when you know, you're trying to flip a model on its head. People are resistant to change. We know that.
Right. Yeah, they resist change.
But there's not a whole lot that seems to be a real big buy-in of this except to sit down and spend some real time and talk fairly honestly.
Yeah, I think that's going to change, too. I think that it is going to get into the public schools here. It's just a matter of time when
let's ask, if you're listening now and you have a child in public school, would this be a kind of model that you would support, as opposed to the rather punitive one that we use right now? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. This is kind of tough stuff to talk about, but it could just be a life changer. It certainly has been for Frank and in some ways for Martine, and certainly for Lauren Walker, who administrates the program. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Do we need to import this earlier into our kids' experiences so hopefully they never wind up in prison and have to have restorative justice circles, more simply a way of, which is more like what Ho'oponopono in some ways too.
Yes.
Every tradition has that, but that's one that we have a lot of here. It's almost odd that we don't do it more.
Yeah, we need to do it more. So it's a matter of how to do it more, how to get that happening, and I think it just takes leadership.
And is there leadership?
I think so. I understand that there's a new charter school coming on that's going to be doing restorative practices.
Well, that's one.
And the Buddhist school, too. The principal of the Buddhist school wants to implement restorative practices.
That's two. All right. Well, we got a couple callers on the line. I guess everybody's driving home and just woke up. Yes, we're here. We're talking about restorative justice. Going now to Max calling us from Maui. Aloha, Max. Thanks.
Hi. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit more about, you know, how the cases are chosen to be a successful candidate for a restorative justice circle. I think you were talking about how the inmates apply while they're incarcerated, and I was just wondering how you would choose which case to go with.
I mean, ideally, you said you would like to do every case if you could, but right now, since you can't and you have to pick and choose, what's your criteria?
Well, we take the cases that we only are able to do about a third of the people who apply for them. We are only able to provide about a third of the circles. And we take them usually. Our priority is who's getting out soonest. You know, if someone's getting out soon, then we try to give them one. But we are open to anyone who takes responsibility and wants to be accountable and repair the harm. And if, you know, 50% of all people who've been harmed by crime want to have these restorative practices. So we would do
it. So those are the types of questions that you would ask, you know, do you want to be accountable? You know, what kind of role does the facilitator play? You know, I know that you were mentioning part of the process, or one of the guests was saying that you set up a plan, or there are little goals that you can set up, but what kind of questions does the facilitator ask in the circles?
Yes, we ask what they hope for, what does their future look like that they want. You know, we try not to use the word goals. Sometimes people get freaked out by not having goals, right? So So, yeah, the facilitator asks questions. And we do ask, we train the facilitators to ask, you know, these restorative questions, which are who was affected by what you did in your imprisonment? Who was affected? How were they affected? And then for the people who are present, who were affected, we ask them what could that person do to repair the harm.
I mean, those are pretty simple questions and profound all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Very.
Max, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
And for pointing us in the direction of some practicality in discussing all of this, too. Going down to Hal calling us from Kahului. Aloha, Hal. Thanks for your patience.
Aloha. Oh, thank you. I just wanted to comment and say that the lady's personal life, what she changed around, is really great. And the idea of getting somebody in there to help and talk with these youngsters and get it worked out with the family, just like you said, I think that's just a fantastic thing, that communication is hard to beat. And I hope this gets around to a lot of different places that has these problems.
Anything you think that you might be able to do, Hal?
Oh,
I mean, lots of people call and say it's a great idea.
I don't have any children in school, but I would love to help have something like that happen. I'm in Kahului, but, you know, I'm in school, actually. It's 68 years old, but I can see it just makes sense. It's really a great story.
All right, Hal, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Our number is 941-3689 if you're on Oahu, use that one. And if you're calling us from the neighbor islands, 877, then the 941-3689. We're talking about restorative justice circles and looking at the idea of what if this were applied to what our kids experience in school before someone had to go through the experience of being incarcerated. If we could somehow change the punitive model to one that was more restorative and bring people together who had been hurt or harmed and find some way of creating healing. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going now to Paige calling us from Maui. Aloha, Paige.
Aloha. I hate to inject a note of negativity to this. I think it's a wonderful idea, but as a peripheral players on the outside, they're met with a lot of staff. Staff, they're unionized, they're conflictual, and they hate change. And so anything that's introduced which is tantamount to adding to their workload, they're, you know, vehemently against.
Well, let's see if that supposition is true. So Paige is saying that, people are resistant to change, which we know, and that all this sounds really good. But how are you going to get the buy-in from people in prisons who might be involved with this and have to change how they do what they do? And same thing at school. When you're asking models to change, that's not easy.
Sure. Well, what we've done is we just show them. We invite them to come and watch the circles. And people who watch them, all of them have appreciated the value of them. And we've, you know, people who work at the prisons who at first were skeptical ended up becoming some of our greatest allies and supporting it and helping us.
So it really is a case with this, with seeing is believing.
Yes. Yeah.
And at least come and experience it.
Yeah. And it's like the other caller, I think Hal said, that it's common sense. This is common sense way of dealing with
it may be, but for somebody who is very much reared in a punitive tradition of the eye for the eye and really angry and really, you know, so full of resentment about what has happened, that how can you expect someone like that to engage with someone who may want to change if, they're not willing to participate in the process? Martine?
Actually, when I was going to go to my circle, I had I was thinking more of like a roast of my mom. I was just going to let her have it and just rip her a new one to say. But actually, after listening to everyone else, I was like, okay, I'm just kind of going to be mean at that point. So I just want to say things that actually would really help her understand how I felt more than just be mean. Because after seeing everyone else talk, I was like, okay, I'm glad I went like last.
But, so you sort of readjusted yourself as you heard other people talk because you realized the purpose was a little bit different than getting out there and just sort of beating her over the head with all the nasty things she'd done to you.
Well, yeah. I was still like mad, but it was, supposed to help each other. So it's not just
yell at her. You can be mad, right? But it's in the way in which you talk about your anger.
Yeah.
Which seems to be what happened to you as you listened to everybody else talk. Mm-hmm. it changed the way you were going to approach your mom.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we've got more callers online going now to Nicole calling from Kaimuki. Aloha, Nicole.
Aloha. I just wanted to say that I think that this restorative justice concept should be used like in a family setting, in a social setting. Like it's not, it doesn't just have to be for, you know, in the educational system or after a really serious crime. Even it's like to correct a behavior, to make that person understand that, you know, there are ramifications of their actions and how they affect people. That's important for kids, you know, in an elementary school level.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, it's almost going back to it's a wonderful life mentality that you don't realize how many people are affected by your one small life until suddenly, you know, it's not there. We don't get to all have that kind of mm-hmm. Frank Capra moment, but by the same token, to understand that people have felt an impact from your actions and have them tell you what they are is pretty profound when someone catches you at your own stuff.
Right. And you have to teach that accountability. You know, that starts that can start young, the feeling that you're responsible for your actions.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, thanks so much for the call. Going now to Pete calling us from Moanalua. Aloha, Pete.
Hey, aloha. Aloha, Lauren Walker. This is Pete Doctor from back in the day.
Oh, hi, Pete. How are you?
I'm doing good. I've been in the DOE since 2002.
Okay.
And, of course, as you remember, back in the day, I actually had helped with some of those circles.
Yeah.
Calling a response to you guys put out a call to feedback about its application in the DOE, I say we couldn't use it enough. I mean, we need that kind of stuff, not only because of dressing with, you know, day-to-day behavioral issues, but because of the empowering effect, the problem-solving skills it instills, and then the practice of it by both adults and youth.
Mm-hmm.
There's just, I couldn't say enough good things about it, being in the system now, DOE. And I could also address, I know Lauren said, I'm interested in what's happening, not why mm-hmm. people are resistant. If I could offer a few reasons real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because you had a previous caller, you know, blame unions for it, teachers union. I mean, even if teachers had a union, had an effect on it, this call did not make any sense because teachers don't make these discipline policies. Anyway, so the three reasons why there's resistance, one is cultural. This would be, you know, cultural ethnic reasons that come from more dominator hierarchical cultures, you know, Confucian society, so forth. Then you have ideological, those that have a political agenda, those that would support the prison industry kind of model that, you know, just throw them in jail kind of mentality, solution to everything.
Right,
and
then
the last
about
is
ago.
Institutional. Yeah. And that is the bureaucratic thinking where it's not really intentional, but it's just efficiency. When you're dealing with so many people, they just want quick action. Maybe it doesn't really address the problem, but it just gets rid of the problem immediately when you have so many, the system's so overwhelmed and under-resourced. So I would say those are three different but related reasons why there's so much resistance. That has nothing to do with unions.
All right, Pete, you did a really good job. Thanks so very much for calling in.
Thanks, Pete. Keep in touch.
And going now to Robert from Nu'uanu. Aloha, Robert. Thanks for your patience.
Aloha. How are you?
Doing pretty well, thanks. What do you make of all this?
Well, I was a high school principal in Colorado for 8 years, and we used restorative justice pretty much for every major infraction with students. And it totally transformed the school to just an incredible place. I'm now the new head of Pacific Buddhist Academy here in Hawaii.
Yeah, right.
And we are talking about the school and using that as the model there and then maybe training our kids to kind of get out and show people what the benefits are for the school. It is dramatic when you use it with teenagers.
I mean, clearly you've had that experience. How do you share that experience with others who are involved, whether in their DOE level or private school, to make that difference known to them? How do you make them understand?
One thing is we did a lot of role play with students and had students act out the roles of you know, the person who was the victim and the person who actually did it. And the students did a great job role playing, and it really helped people understand. But for some of the teachers in the school, it was still a problem because they didn't see a student really punished and hurt. You know, they wanted retribution for an action when it was really about repairing the harm. And as a principal, the relationships I was able to build with these kids was amazing because the harm was repaired. Mm-hmm. And the student could look at me the next day in the eye and everybody in the school and say, I did what I needed to do to make it right. And it changed the way the school dealt with issues. And I was involved with probably 90 of these, pretty much always as the victim. If it was graffiti, the principal was the victim. If it was a fight in school, I was one of the people affected, other than the kids who were fighting. So I've sat in a lot of these, and I think we had one or two go bad, and then the rest were just brilliant. They really were.
So, Robert, when you mentioned that, you know, there are some people who just want that eye for an eye, they really want that sense of retribution, it kind of means maybe they need to do some work on themselves with all of this, but meanwhile, they're still engaged in a system. How do you begin to help them, or you just don't focus on them, you just focus on the ones who are paying attention?
Both. I think both. We invited teachers to sit in the hearings, in the justice circles, and when they sat in and see what the student had to go through to take accountability and what the student had to go through to make it right, they understood there was punishment. They did. They understood that it was made right. And some of those teachers were turned over, but there were some teachers we just couldn't, persuade, and it was just we were going to go about it this way. And we still held kids accountable. We still suspended them if they needed to be suspended, but the repairing the harm, they would then be able to come back to the community and be a productive member as opposed to just a punished person now looking for maybe more. And that was one of the dramatic things. But sometimes a student needs to be accountable, and they're not ready to be a part of a community. And the idea is to let them repair the harm to come back. So they're not definitely separate, but they could be.
The point of it is you're letting them lead the process in a way once they're involved with the process. I mean, if there's no magic time frame, there's no magic button that suddenly they get it. You have to let them do it at their own pace, but they do
Correct.
Get it.
And some things happen. In one of the restorative justices, the student wanted to make it right with her family by asking them if they could eat dinner together 3 nights a week. And that was one of the ways we solved the issue was the parents decided they were going to eat dinner as a family together. And
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're losing your signal a little bit, but just want to tell you thanks so much for the call, and you're getting a lot of smiles and nods around the table as you talked about that. Very briefly, I mean, you hear about someone trying to make some sense of restorative justice healing by saying, well, I want us all to sit down and eat together a couple nights a week, which we know from research is a very good thing when families can do that. There's a much better chance of having a healthy, happy family. Those kinds of things don't seem to point to the fact that there are kids who really would like to see that kind of normalcy come back. And if they have to act out to be able to get it, that might be a viable way to do it. The point is maybe not getting there in the first place, if at all possible. We're coming down to the last part of the hour. I know it's gone by very quickly. You guys have done some amazing work. I'm just so impressed with your level of honesty and willingness to share that with those of us who have not gone through what you've gone through. But as you leave us, a couple of words of advice of how you'd like to see certain situations that you know happen in daily life where you think this could be really of value, and maybe some questions that you would ask us to ask ourselves in thinking about how we make restitution and how we create some sense of healing. Really, really quickly, you got about 10 seconds. What do you got? What do we do first?
Well, I think we just have to talk about things, how we've been affected by things and what we can do to repair things.
Martine?
It's
okay. Frank?
I'm kind of stumped on that one also, too. I just think that circles are really a good thing to have. They should have them all over, like how everybody was saying on the air. It just changed me totally into a positive new person that has a lot of confidence now.
But it's got to be a willingness to engage with everybody and talk pretty openly and pretty honestly, as you've been doing with your loved ones, and they've certainly done with you. Frank, thank you so much for being here. We wish you all the best, and keep us posted. Martine, it's okay. Bing Tun Tai's all right. Got a lot of emotion, a lot of stuff to do. Thanks so much. And Lauren Walker, thank you very much for being here. And I will see you tomorrow morning right here for The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.